crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nuchtigal. I'm coming to you from Jerusalem, Israel. It's about 4 o'clock local time here in the afternoon, Sunday, November 18th. For today's program, I'm going to recap the events of the past week, primarily going through what took place on Monday afternoon into Tuesday afternoon. No doubt you're all aware of the huge barrage of rockets that were unleashed by Hamas and other Palestinian terrorist factions in the Gaza Strip on Israel, upwards of about 500, almost 500 rockets, mortars, and missiles came through into Israeli territory, most of those landing within about 10 kilometers of the Gaza-Israeli border. And this was the largest barrage of rockets that we've seen in that short amount of time, about 25 hours. And on Tuesday morning, when just after most of those had come through, at least 300 of those, 350 by that point, had come through, I visited this area and spent all the daylight portion of the day inside this 10-kilometer strip on the Gaza border, right underneath where this rocket and missile fire was coming. And as I experienced on that day, I came to recognize more fully just the huge threat and the difficult life that Israelis within this territory do suffer from, and how this has been going on. Obviously, this was a huge barrage of rockets, but this has been going on for 15 years. And you have a couple of years where there might be a dry spell, but then you have a war or something like this that happens over a couple day period where everyone in southern Israel, over 500,000 people that are affected by this, are heading into their shelters, are sleeping in their shelters, a lot of them, if they've got a shelter in their homes. You've got children that have grown up with this threat, and that's all they know. If they live on one of these border towns, one of the kibbutzes, mushavim, or towns that are in this area, that's all they know. That's all these children know if they're 15 years of age. And that fact just implanted itself in my mind, listening to a lot of the residents speak about the difficulty they face and the stress and the trauma that their children are going through. No child, no adult for that matter, deserves such a life. And yet these Israelis, as I talk to them, while they hate these conditions and it brings them to tears to see the effect that it has on their children, they are defiantly staying there. They don't want to leave. Their children apparently don't want to leave. They understand the importance to ensure that Israel is on its border. And if the terrorists or Hamas wants them to leave by firing these rockets at them to get pushed back from the border, they're not going to do it, as so many of them told me. And so what I'm going to do for today's program is go through some of the personal testimony of people living in this Gaza envelope, as it's called, and then you can get a clear take of what these people experience. It's more important to hear them speak when they with their own words. I did write an article about this. It's up on Watch Jerusalem right now. It's entitled "A Reporter's Diary: A Day in the Gaza Envelope. On a day of 400 rockets, I tasted the effects of 15 years of war and the world's oldest racism." And it goes through the different stops that we made on this journey. But I do want you to, even if you've read that, just to listen to the program, because there's something that the human voice conveys that is lost in the print, or especially if you're not the best writer, as I'm not. It's hard to capture the emotion of the personalities behind these comments. And so what we're going to do now is hear from the people that I had the chance to interview. I was with about 10 other journalists, and there is a group here in Jerusalem called Media Central, and they organize such tours. They are committed to free and fair reporting, and basically they are facilitators to the to reporting. And so they led this tour and basically stopped us at these different places where we could interview anybody we wanted. And so this is the testimony from last Tuesday morning. We arrived there about 10:50. We started at the Ashkelon residence of the man, the one fatality, which is just amazing that only one person died with all these rockets that were coming in and missiles that were coming in. We started in Ashkelon, 5 Jabotinsky Street. This is where this massive rocket or missile took out the whole eastern part of a building. It was a four-story building, one of the older buildings in this area. There was a lot of Ethiopian Jews, it seemed, around the place. Many of them didn't speak English. Many of them didn't even speak Hebrew that well also. And when I arrived there, the place was just crawling with press, international Israeli press. And I was just really dismayed looking at the amount of damage that this grad rocket, it seemed, at least that was what we were told it was, from the police spokesman that was there. It was just incredible to see the whole eastern part of this building blown away. The top floor of it, we got to tour through the building itself, and where the man was killed, he was actually a Palestinian man from the Hebron region. He didn't even get out of bed, and it looks like this rocket came right for his bedroom and just destroyed it completely. But it wasn't just his room, his apartment, that was damaged. The apartment adjacent to his on the same floor was just, it just looked like a tornado had gone through it. Walls were destroyed. The floor was just covered in everything that was in the house, I guess. And there were two other women in this building that were severely injured as well. And then there were a number of other injuries that weren't as severe. But I was really dismayed at how big this bomb was, or this missile. On Thursday, Jerusalem Post reported that the day earlier, Islamic Jihad, one of the Palestinian groups that has said that did fire a lot of these weapons, and this is a group that obviously takes direction and funding directly from Iran, even more so than Hamas does. They reported that, well, they released pictures of a brand new rocket, and they allegedly said it was the one that did hit Ashkelon, and it was a rocket that was equipped with an oversized warhead that could carry a warhead of about 200 kilograms. And just looking at this damage, it seems like, I'm no expert, but as this article brings out, it quotes experts saying that it was likely this new rocket that they have that isn't able to travel that far, but man, it can pack a payload. Anyway, we did walk through this. I was surprised that we could walk through the whole building and that nobody was there to determine whether it was, well, I'm sure they determined whether it was safe or not to have all these people traipsing through, all these journalists, but we did. And then it wasn't just the top floor that was blown away. The bottom, the floors underneath that, there was just blood everywhere. It's blood on the doorways where people had, you could tell they were bleeding. They got up and they were trying to escape the building. And just a surreal moment to know that people had experienced a terrifying ordeal. They only had, I think, 15 to 20 seconds. They're meant to have about 30 seconds to get to a safe zone in this town of Ashkelon, but I don't think they had it this time with this bomb, at least, or this missile, at least according to some of the testimony that we heard. And so after touring that, it was just a sobering reminder of what was taking place, what could happen anywhere within 10, 15, 20 kilometers of the Gaza Strip. These missiles and rockets, these aren't precision guided. And so they just fire them in the direction of a town, and hopefully they hit. Of course, Israel has the Iron Dome system that does knock out a lot of the rockets, and it seemed to hit about 25 to 30% of the rockets that were fired, or missiles that were fired, which is a really large percentage compared back to the 2014 war. There was only about 16% of the missiles were targeted by and shot down by the Iron Dome. Of course, Iron Dome only decides to hit those, at least we're told, only decides to hit those that are going to hit a built-up area. And so it seems that because of the increase in the proportion that Iron Dome took out, maybe they did decide or did have a way of getting these more accurately targeted on civilian centers. Nevertheless, after we went from 5 Jabotinsky Street looking at this devastation, we actually interviewed a man whose backyard bordered on another property that was hit by another missile in Ashkelon. And he lived at 3 Hatikva Street. And it was interesting. His name was Tzur Zekari. And just to hear him talk, he wasn't expecting to be home at this time, but he was. And thankfully he was, because he could help his 3 daughters and 5-month-old boy get to safety before they were impacted by this blast. And so I'm going to just allow you to hear a couple of minutes here from his own words. This is Tzur Zekari. He's a 48-year-old real estate agent whose life has been completely upended by the rockets that are coming from Gaza.
We have, usually we had about, was about 20 seconds to find a refuge, okay? Mm-hmm. I don't know how happened that they're much faster now. We don't even have 5 seconds or 10 seconds at least to find a shelter. So we have 4 kids. We had those 2 elder girls on the second floor, and I was feeding my baby, and the 33-year-old was just she froze. She couldn't know what to do. All the blast, once this building got the missile, we just closed the shelter room, and after a millisecond, we hear a huge blast, and all the windows at my living room was all scattered through that sofa where I was feeding my baby. So imagine what would happen. The dilemma here is a constant. It's a battle which is ongoing, unfortunately, which is taking a huge toll of us in emotional stress. I see my kids. I see they're suffering on a constant basis. Whenever they see, they hear even a sound of a jet plane flying over, they are just they're shimmering. They're scared. And I as a father cannot give him the adequate comfort, and whatever I can try to explain it that it's okay, we are defending our borders, and it's heartbreaking. That's the reality that we live in, and it's I cannot imagine if somebody from Europe or the UK or any sovereign country which respects its borders would have agreed with this atrocity. Last week we had my daughters would not go up to their to live at their everyone has their own room, and they would not agree. They are cramped in the small room because they're frightened. We don't know what to expect. We don't know when the next blow will come.
With all the flare-ups in the last month, do you still have hope for a long-term truce between Hamas and Israel?
Everyone is hopeful. Everyone is hopeful. I hope that they would find a way that, first of all, to sit and have a common dialogue to see how they can rebuild Gaza. We really, as Israeli, want them to live happily, to prosper, to have their own right, to have their... We don't have anything to deal with them. We want them to be happy.
The words of Tzur Zekari in Ashkelon, who was impacted by one of the missiles that landed behind his property. And as I was listening to him, I was just amazed at his level of patience and goodwill and the fact that he still desired to have peace with these people that were deliberately targeting him, maybe not him individually, but that isn't comforting, the fact that they just decide that they could hit a baby, a 5-month-old baby boy, just sitting on a couch getting fed from a bottle, that, you know, that could be one of the legitimate targets for Hamas. And here he was, unable to comfort his children and provide them with the comfort of the protection that he would want to as a father, and yet he was still willing to put out an olive branch with these people to just get along. This is our sovereign territory. You can have that land. We're happy to work together. Just leave us be. And I was actually surprised to find that that type of thinking was actually typical, from everyone that I talked to. Yes, they can get angry about the bombs, of course, and the missiles and the constant threat of missiles. But at the same time, they wanted peace. They didn't want retribution. They just wanted it to stop. After we left Ashkelon, we visited the headquarters, or the regional headquarters, I guess you could call it, of Magen David Adom in Sderot. Sderot, of course, comes under threat, has done for so much, or comes under, it is targeted, this town, because of its population and its proximity to the northeastern corner of the Gaza Strip. And we there spoke with Yonatan Yogodovsky. He's the director there, the international spokesman for Magen David Adom. And he had some interesting comments that I'd like to share with you.
Welcome to the Magen David Adom Sderot station. The station is one of many stations that are in the area of the Lachish and the north and western Negev region of Magen David Adom. Since yesterday afternoon, over the last 20 hours, we are in a higher level of alert. All of our vehicles are fully deployed with teams. We're talking about several dozens of life-saving vehicles, ambulances, mobile intensive care units, command vehicles, and medicycles. Our teams are living in the communities who are part of this area, and their families are part of the civilians that are constantly under attack over the last 20 hours. But when everybody is being called to run into the bomb shelter, our teams are running out to the ambulances, to the medicycles, in order to reach to their neighbors and to try and assist them. And since yesterday, it's around 4:30 p.m., Magen David Adom teams treated 55 people. We are receiving constant bombardment of mortar shells over the last 20 hours, but this is an escalation of an ongoing situation that's been going on for a very, very long time between Gaza, from Gaza, towards the Israeli civilian communities. The PTSD, the stress disorders, are something that everybody here lives with and cope with, each one in their own manner, in their own way. Kids, teenagers, are wetting their beds. Parents are afraid to go to work, afraid to send their kids to school, because even though in Sderot every bus stop is a bomb shelter, but still people are afraid to send their kids in the morning to school. You see the dome over there? There's a big cement dome. This is a dome that protects a school against direct hits. The stress became a part of life, and people are trying to deal with it.
So as Yonatan Yogodovsky talked about that that concrete dome, I looked over my shoulder and there it was, this huge dome that kind of resembles something that more akin to a sporting facility, which is covered to protect it from rain. But this one protects it from raining missiles, protects the children so they can go to school. On this day, school was canceled all through the region because it was just so dangerous. And the children would have been petrified to come to school anyhow. But that's normal. That's what you have to do to have a sense of normalcy in the South, is you have to create a concrete dome over your school so that you can protect it from direct hits. Another interesting thing he said about his ambulances is that a lot of them are bulletproof. Bulletproof. So that they don't come under attack, because sometimes they do. And he even, his teams were one of the first responders to get to the IDF soldier that was walking beside the bus that was blown up from the Gaza Strip that day. One of the things that set off all the violence. And he said as his crews were working on that man, they were coming under bullet fire. They were being shot at. That is an ambulance worker in the south of Israel. That's what they have to go through. And I think it's significant as well that he was talking about the major impacts of this reality, of the rocket reality, the missile reality in the south. It isn't the actual destruction that is caused by the rockets or missiles that land. It's the stress. It's the abnormal situation and the stress that creates on everybody, on being a moment from having to run to a shelter in the middle of the night, if you have to. Doesn't matter what you're doing. You're always aware that it's a possibility, and the effect that it has on the children. That is something that was brought out also in Sderot when we talked to the deputy mayor. We talked to the deputy mayor just straight after we left Megan David Adom. Alad Kalimi is his name. We interviewed him right by the burnt out bakery, another target that was hit during this barrage of rockets late Monday night. And so here is he, Deputy Mayor Alad Kalimi of Sderot.
It's one of four bombs that landed yesterday on Sderot. There was here a very a stock of gas, about 3 tons of gas that was here, and it's a miracle that nobody hurt. But generally, this part of this horrible day, it's one of 15 years that we live here in an emergency routine. Emergency routine, it's always back to when they in Gaza get mad of something, we in Sderot, the children of Sderot suffer. And this is unnormal, totally unnormal situation. I have 6 kids, all of them have problems of post-traumatic disorders with in high level or low level, but they're all in these problems. It's worse than war, because war, you know it, it begin, you know that you should run to a shelter, to wait till it end, and that's all. Here it's not. Because every minute you can hear the siren, you can hear the rockets, you can hear the Iron Dome, that and it's every minute. All there was rain next last week, and my little child thought that the bombs of the clouds, yeah, these bombs are rockets. So she ran to the shelter. So this is the situation.
Heartbreaking. I have 2 kids, a 2.5-year-old and an 8-month-old here in Jerusalem with me. And just having this tour as a father and hearing these other fathers talk about their children suffering in this way, and even Zachary, Mr. Zachary as well, talking about his inability to protect them. That's the responsibility of parents, and especially the father, to look after the children, to ensure that they're safe, and to ensure that they're safe not just physically but mentally and emotionally, and that they grow up in an environment that fosters positivity. And I don't know how they do it. I don't know how they act as will try and fulfill their roles as fathers or mothers in this living under this constant threat. And you can see why so many in the south of Israel are completely dismayed by the response of the government. I'm sure the government has its reasons for not just totally destroying Hamas so that it can't threaten southern Israel in this way. I'm sure they are looking into ways to try and do that. But this has been going on for a while. It's been going on for 15 or 16 years, and not much has changed for the residents of southern Israel. And so they're marching to Jerusalem, they march at the Knesset, they try and stop some of the convoys getting through to feed Hamas and the Palestinians there, not because they're angry at the Palestinians there. They just want to get the attention of the government to try and fix this problem. But you hear commentators, everyone has a solution or a potential solution, but most people know this is a situation that cannot be fixed easily, if at all. And that is that this longstanding policy of being unable to fix the problem, at best mowing the grass for a couple of years before the threat returns, that is creating a sense of hopelessness in some ways for the people of the South. Now, this next interview, and this will be the last one that I play on the program, this is with a mother. She probably is in her late 40s, I would say, although she has such a bubbly personality that you wouldn't expect. It doesn't sound like she's that old. She has about 6 or 7 children herself. The youngest one was 9. I think the eldest is in her late 20s. And she moved to Sderot just 1 year before the rockets started. And so she's been there the whole time, and her kids have been going through this the whole time as well with their family. And I hope you go to our article at Watch Jerusalem about this, because it's got a picture of this lady who I asked her if I could take a picture of her just so I could, you know, put a face to the quote in the article. And she said, "Should I smile?" And you can see in the background that she's in front of the burnt out bakery in Sderot. And I said, "Yeah, please smile, because that's your personality. You've been doing this interview with us. You're almost in tears, yet you've got this smile on your face. That is just, it's a jarring reality or jarring image once you go and see this picture. But this is her personality, which I think is just remarkable given the situation that she's in. So here are some comments from Sderot resident Atara Orenbach.
It's very hard. I mean, it's always thinking what's going to happen if any activity you want to do, anytime you want to leave the house. It's thinking where I could run away, where's the shelter. It's only 7 seconds. It's very difficult. I mean, not once or twice we had red alerts, and then I had to go to the doctor with a child, and they said, "No, how do we go to the doctor?" I said, "We have no choice. We'll just go to the doctor." We don't think of leaving. The children don't even want to leave. They like Sderot. Sderot is a lovely place, lovely people. We want to live here quietly, just like each one of you wants to live in your own town or city quietly. And as you would expect the government to retaliate when if there would be, if they would bomb you, if the terrorists would bomb, you would expect the government to do something. I expect the government to do something, whatever they have to do. I'm not a government person, I'm not an army person, but I accept them. I live in Israel, and I want to feel safe. We get help in terms of mental help, because that's the most problem. My children go on and off into all kinds of psychologists and whatever. We try to give them, strengthen them as much as we can. But it's certainly the problems. A lot of bedwetting, even older children, apparently a lot of bedwetting. Mm. Probably it's not easy to sit and study. Sleep at night is not always quiet sleep. So it's like a daily, it's all the time. It's 24 hours, it's 7 days a week, it's all the time. It sits there someplace. And we all jump to any door that closes to loud noises. Even if we're outside Sderot, it's part of our system. My son today, for instance, is supposed to come home. He's in 10th grade, and he dorms outside of Sderot. because there was better school that he wanted, and he's supposed to come home today. And he asked me, should I come home? He asked to go to Be'er Sheva, which was very dangerous last night, and he was debating. And we said maybe he should go to his married sister, who lives closer, and he doesn't have to come to this area. And that's what he decided to do. He just sent me a message that he'll go to her. It's very sad that he has to think not to come home this free day and go elsewhere. I mean, that's something really sad to me. And even also when she we have a grandchild, she has a son, and yesterday she was supposed to come for something. I called her, said, don't come. And she tells me, but you grew, all your children grew up that way. You had babies here. I said, yeah, I know what it is, and I don't want to go back to that trauma, and it's my grandson. I mean, I remember the trauma of nursing and running into the shelter room in the middle of nursing, in the middle of diapering, and taking a baby in the middle of sleep. It's terrible. So I told her, I don't want you to, if you don't live here, if you live here, you live here. But if you don't live here, you don't have to come when it's the hardest days.
Tseva Adom. That's the alert. That's the alert that these children have grown up hearing all of their lives. 7 to 10 seconds if they're in Sderot to find shelter, to stop whatever they're doing, grab the nearest kid, and run into shelter. It's not long at all. Now, after our meetings there at Sderot, we traveled a little bit further south to Kibbutz Kisufim, which is just 2 kilometers away from the Gaza border, and talked with a number of officials there as well. After that, we completed our trip. We were going on the way back to Jerusalem. We had to go northwards. We passed through Yad Mordecai and ate at a little restaurant there. And, you know, we were there, in the restaurant, we were kind of surprised that we didn't hear or see up to that point, or didn't have to run for shelter. I mean, the missiles that did come during that day, it was like they were following us wherever we went as soon as we left, be it Ashkelon, Sederot, or Kisufim. I mean, we have the Red Alert app on the phone that tells you where there's a missile coming in. And it seemed that they were just everywhere just after we left. And being a bunch of journalists, there was a little bit of disappointment at that lack of action. And I'm kind of ashamed to say that I was a little disappointed as well, that I didn't get to experience that, the Tseva Adom, as I was sitting there in the restaurant. But then it happened. I was just ordering a coffee at the counter. I didn't actually hear it go off immediately, and somebody yelled out, Tseva Adom, Tseva Adom. And we all just raced, clerk, barrister, officers that were there in the army, journalists, were all huddled then in the bathroom, going to the shelter to try and escape this bomb, this missile. Now, I don't know where it landed, or if it did land, or if it was shot out of the sky by the Iron Dome, but almost immediately, within a couple of seconds of arriving in the bathroom, the alarm stopped, and the employees went back to work as if nothing abnormal had happened to them. And as I realized at that point, nothing abnormal had happened to them. This was their normal. This was their everyday. Every day, this is possible. Now, for me, it was more than abnormal at that moment. It was surreal. I mean, this wasn't just an alarm that went off. It was an alarm that said that a few kilometers away from me, someone had just pointed a missile or a rocket that was filled with explosives and shrapnel and ignited it with the intent to kill and headed it in my direction. Now, of course, Hamas or Islamic Jihad, whoever fired that, they had aimed at me specifically. I mean, he didn't know I was there. But that fact didn't comfort me, that he didn't know who the person was. In fact, makes it even more unnerving. This whoever lit the fuse on that thing had the purpose in mind of killing anybody and everybody as long as they were a Jew, as long as they were Israeli. Civilian, soldier, man, woman, five-month-old boy that's on the couch in his father's arms drinking milk. It didn't matter. His intent was to kill Jews. Now, while many describe this ongoing war between Israel and Hamas as being motivated by Palestinian nationalism or this desire for a state that they have, I mean, that's so easy to see through that it's not even worth commenting on. The reason that these rockets and missiles are happening is not because they have a bad life in Gaza. It's because they want to kill Jews. They want to kill Israelis. I realized at that point that it's impossible not to view the indiscriminate rocket fire at a civilian population center as an extension of the world's oldest racism. Hatred of the Jews, desire to get rid of the Jews. That day in Gaza, or on the border of Gaza on Tuesday, I saw that hatred up close, and the effect that it is having on the population of Israel in the south. Now, what's motivating these people to fire weapons like this, capable of mass murder at a crowd of Jews? It happens so frequently that we forget that every single missile has murderous intent behind it. That's the desire. And if they had bigger missiles, they would use them. If they had a greater ability to kill more Jews, they would do it. They would do it. What possesses a mind to go after another race like that? And specifically, we've seen throughout history that they target the Jews. That this world has targeted the Jews more than any other race of people, and it continues to this day. It's interesting, just before I'm recording this, just checking the news and looking at the General Assembly of the United Nations, and they voted on nine things. I think it was yesterday or even today. It might have been yesterday. Nine different resolutions. And what were those nine resolutions about? Every single one of them was against Israel, as if Israel is perpetrating war crimes and all these other things that nobody else in the world is. Why is the UN so concerned about Israel? Well, it's fundamentally the same reason why Hamas and the other Palestinian groups there are firing rockets indiscriminately at Jewish civilians in Israel. Now, this anti-Semitism, it's so commonplace, but it is completely misunderstood. Everyone, it seems, has an idea of why anti-Semitism exists, but there is a clear reason of why it exists. And in a way, the reason for anti-Semitism is a source of hope in itself. Now, the Bible reveals that this spirit of wanting to rid the world of an entire race of people comes from the devil. There is a spirit world out there. There is a wicked being that actually rules over this earth right now. And he has an intense hatred for all mankind. But specifically, he has a hatred for the biblical nation of Judah, and which is Israel, this modern state of Israel. And he spreads that hatred like a disease across the world. This kind of bitter, resentful hate is a contagion that Satan is using to direct a great many people in this world today. Now, God has an awesome purpose, has had an awesome purpose for the Jews, and has an awesome purpose for the Jews and for the rest of Israel too, the Jewish nation just being one of those tribes of Israel. And that plan that God has for the Jews is something that Satan hates, that he absolutely hates, and he's tried to snuff it out through history. Now, this is the true yet astonishing reason behind the intense hatred for Israel today. It defies reality if you don't think of anything in terms of a spirit motivating this evil throughout history against the Jews. There is no other logical reason for it. The devil hates God's plan, and the Jews have a part in God's plan, and he's doing all he can to destroy it. Now, if you want to look at the deeper causes of anti-Semitism, as well as the prophesied end to such a hatred, it is going to come to an end. It is going to stop, but it's not going to stop until Satan is stopped, and we know that he definitely will. If you want to read more about how that's going to happen and how even these events on the Gaza border between Hamas and Israel right now actually have a part in leading the way to those hope-filled prophecies, you can please go ahead and read the Key of David booklet. It is by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, specifically chapter 8 of that booklet. It's a free booklet. You can download it or you can request a hard copy. I will leave a link for this booklet on the show notes today. And all you need to do is click on that, read it, understand the true source of this hatred for the Jews, and then also read about how it is coming to an end. There is an end to the rocket fire coming on the southern on the residents of southern Israel. It's going to stop, and it's going to stop for good, and it's going to happen soon. So please request and read that booklet. That's all we have time for today. Thank you very much for listening into the program. If you would like to send me some feedback, please do so by writing your emails to letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. I'll talk to you next week.